duties. We'll speak with Congressman Peter Kossmeyer, Democrat from Bucks County, who recently returned from a fact-finding mission to El Salvador and Nicaragua. At about 4, I'll speak with Rudolf Barrow, one of the founding members of West Germany's Green Party. Barrow, one of the Green Party's leading theoreticians, has written critiques of Marxism and proposed as an alternative a synthesis of Marxism and the ecology movement. After the publication of his book, The Alternative in Eastern Europe, he was imprisoned in his native East Germany on charges of publishing state secrets. He served an 8-year sentence and was then expelled from the country. He's since lived in West Germany. With me now on Fresh Air is Michael Graves, who is probably the most controversial and most talked about architect working today in America. To quote New York Times architecture critic Paul Goldberger, Graves' popularity has led him to be praised in some circles as the greatest architect of his time and denounced in others as a mere creature of fashion. But the fact of the matter is that Graves, if he is not an epic-making figure, is the most truly original voice that American architecture has produced in some time. His architecture is a kind of collage, an assemblage of parts that speak simultaneously to a public eager for easy visual delight and to a profession that wants an architecture that seems grounded in a theoretical and academic base. His work is dazzling to look at, and yet it deals in issues more profound than simply decoration of construction, unquote. Modern architecture accustomed us to buildings with exteriors of steel and glass or beige poured concrete. Graves' buildings are a radical departure. His exteriors are sometimes patterned in designs that evoke classical architecture or art deco, and he uses color on the outsides like creams, terracotta, and pale blues. Graves is now designing furniture and textiles, and after many years of being known only in art and architecture circles, his work has become so popular that Bloomingdale's recently commissioned him to design a shopping bag for them. Graves was awarded the Prix de Rome in 1960 and studied at the American Academy in Rome for 2 years. In 1962, he returned to America and joined the Princeton University architecture faculty, where he's since been a professor. He's won 11 Progressive Architecture Design Awards, 3 National American Institute of Architects Honor Awards for completed buildings, and was awarded the Arnold W. Brunner Memorial Prize in Architecture from the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters. He's currently the architect for the new wing of the Whitney Museum and the architect for the Newark Museum. His completed projects include the Portland Public Office Building, the Environmental Education Center at Liberty State Park, and the San Juan Capistrano Library. The Moore College of Art is currently exhibiting sketches, models, textiles, and furniture by Michael Graves. This exhibition continues through October 15th, and the gallery is located in the Moore College of Art building at 20th and Ray Streets in Philadelphia. Michael Graves, it's a great pleasure to meet you, and welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Did your work make a sudden break with its own past at some point in your career?
No, I think it seems that way to a lot of people, but it was terribly gradual. From the very earliest buildings to houses in particular, there was an attempt on my part to use color and textures that, in a way, the clients didn't want. They wanted modern architecture, and so they wanted to clean it up a bit. And so I had always been known as somebody who was quite pure, and in that sense, those early buildings, though they are derived from the work of Le Corbusier and the early work of Le Corbusier, were not meant to be white objects in the open field. In time, however, as I worked through that kind of idiom in a number of buildings, I became somewhat dissatisfied in that I thought I might be speaking a private language, and worried that the work was not really accessible to a lot of people. And so little by little I tried ways of making the language more accessible, and today I think that that's probably has occurred in the sense that there has been a steady progression toward an equity between what is abstract and multivalent on one side and on the other those things that are accessible and part of the prose of the language, the easy part of the language.
Labels like postmodernism only go so far in describing somebody's work. Could I ask you to describe in your own words where you see your architecture fitting into contemporary architecture?
Well, that's a difficult one because we're at a difficult time right now, in that we've now had, 50 or 60 years of modern architecture in the sense of what we know as commercial modernism, the kind of steel and glass office buildings that we're all used to, and I sense that many people are alienated by those things and those objects. And there are a number of people today that are trying other things. I'm one of them, but there are many, many people who are making an architecture that is probably more figurative than it is abstract. If one were to say that the steel and glass office buildings that we know so well, you know, all our major cities are overly abstract and very difficult to understand and identify with, then a person like myself and the architecture that I make tends to be figurative in that we can identify with its parts, though the buildings are not necessarily anthropomorphic. They do speak a language, a thematic language, that allows us, at least in a subliminal way, to understand ground as the floor and the soffit as sky and the wall as a recognition that there is indeed nature out there without having to open the whole wall to windows and bring it in literally. There is a metaphoric understanding in the building, and I think that's, in a sense, how architecture becomes figurative.
You said that initially clients seemed to reject the idea of color and some of the ideas that you were working with. What happened that made the time right for you to actually start working with color in projects that you were doing?
Well, there was one kitchen addition, tiny project in Princeton where I volunteered the client to paint the building in the way that I thought it ought to be painted. It was a Victorian building to start with. It was a building with some life of its own, the original building, and I wanted to continue that in the context of the new addition. And I took it a little further than they had expected, but nevertheless, they allowed that I could do that if I were willing to repaint it if they didn't like it. And it's the way I started painting murals as well, where I would volunteer to clients that I would paint their walls with the understanding that if they didn't like what they found on their walls, after seeing cartoons and sketches and that sort of thing before painting, we would erase it and start again or paint it over. And never had to do that, but it was a way of getting a foot in the door.
I think you're thought of now as like breaking with precedent, because the recent precedent on exteriors are steel and glass and poured concrete. But what do you think are the historic precedents that you maybe fit in with of using color?
Well, I'm always curious when people ask, as you just have, about the color question, because for 4,000 or 5,000 years now, we've had colored buildings, and for the past 50 or 60 years, we have not. And if you see modern architecture, and I'm making a caricature of modern architecture when I say this recent past of the kind of sterile buildings that we know are monochromatic by and large, the architect has to work very hard to work the color out of a building, unless all the materials are synthetic, unless they all come from a synthetic process rather than from a natural process. That sounds like a rather down-home comment, but nevertheless, masonry comes from the earth, and wood and other materials that we have used traditionally are all by nature colored, and therefore, if one simply recalls those materials or uses those materials in the work, then there is not the break with the past, but the continuity with the past. It seems to me that the question really ought to be addressed to the modern architect who makes neutral buildings. Why are your buildings so boring? Why are your buildings so gray?
What are your sources of color for exteriors?
Well, the way I suppose we as children drew or painted houses in class or when in art class when we were asked to draw our house or whether we did it on our own, we generally made grass green and the building red like brick and the sky blue, etc., and the sun yellow. All of those childlike motifs are very much with us as adults as well. And the sense that there is an analogy between the color, the material, and the theme or thought that they provide us in reading a building or understanding a building is really what my architecture is about. So that if I make the ground floor of a multi-story building deep or dark or masonry looking, even though it might be, as you said before, poured concrete, it might even be painted concrete, it might be painted to resemble or be like that it once was or perhaps should be, but in this economy can't be. And so it takes on the analogous form of stone and might more firmly root the building in the ground. And again, it's a kind of thematic base to the building. While traveling up through the body of the building, one might ultimately reach the soffit or the top of the building, and there the thing can be much lighter. If, for instance, Tiepolo were alive today and we had a grand room within the top floor of a building, we know that he would paint the soffit or ceiling of that room to recall the heavens. In other words, not only would it be blue, but it would also presume those folks that exist in the heavens. And so he made a whole literate kind of analogous form out of recalling that idea of the bursting through that roof, enlightening the roof by virtue of that kind of painting. So using color to be expressive of the themes of the building is really all that one does. And as I say, it's quite childlike. There isn't anything mysterious about it. And if there were, then again, one would run the risk of being private in the language.
You referred to how you might use poured concrete and painted a color as if it were stone. There are some who would probably say that that's dishonest and that, you know, poured concrete should look like poured concrete and stone should look like stone. Do questions like that ever cause you to think, I mean, worry you or anything? Do you buy that dishonesty question?
Architecture for a long time, again, since Walter Gropius, has been thought to be moral. Architecture is anything but moral. Architecture is an invention. We don't need architecture. We do need building. We do need accommodation. We do need to keep the rain off. However, architecture itself is invented by our society, our culture, around the myths and rituals of our culture. I'm quite bored by the whole idea of morality in architecture. That doesn't mean that you become amoral by making an architecture. It's just simply, in a way, the wrong question to ask of architecture, because it's simply not the point. And the honesty of materials has very little to do with the point as well. There's nothing honest about a plastic wall. And there's nothing honest in a way about an aluminum frame. It's all made up. It's all a technical invention, and that's fine. It's amusing to me that in the first century in Pompeii, where they couldn't afford the marble that was being quarried in Carrara and used in Rome, they painted on in their houses the marble that the Romans could afford and could use. And they became so skilled at it in the next 75 years that the Romans came down to see what this great fuss was about. And they loved the paintings they made on their walls of the imitated garden, and ultimately became our wallpaper. And indeed, they made something called the quadrata, the frame around a picture, a mythic picture within the wall, which became much, much later, of course, our sense of easel painting. When the painting was taken off the wall and then put back on it as a kind of hole through the wall that we would see some idea of an idealized garden. But think of what you can do with the assumption of the garden or the assumption of nature as well as literal nature in conjunction with it. And when you have the whole spectrum to work with, it's really all okay, and nothing is right and nothing is wrong, because again, those aren't the right questions for architecture. Architecture has no right or wrong, except in its measurable sense. The idea that some of architecture is discursive, and we can measure how far it is from here to there, or how warm it is, or how dry it is, and all of those pragmatic questions are answered in every building, and we know, or we can measure how much of a success or how well they function. But they're left out of that question is the symbolic function, the idea that that buildings have this other half of the functional mode, which is the symbol systems that the society has invented. And a building also works or does not work relative to what we think of it, what character it has, what we think when we're in that building, and if we're reacting in ways that are appropriate to the institutions that we're involved in.
Architect Michael Graves is my guest, and there is a show of his work, Models, Sketches, Furniture, and Textiles, now an exhibit at the Moore College of Art on 20th and Ray Streets in Philadelphia in their gallery. You use really beautiful colors in your architecture, and I don't think that architects are like trained in color the way visual artists are. I mean, not that one would necessarily need that training, but is your color work intuitive, or have you done any like serious study of
no,
color?
It is intuitive. That's interesting. I've never been asked that question before, but just yesterday we got, I think, two or three letters from manufacturers of various products who said, obviously wanting to use our colors, but said, please send us your palette, as if it were in your hip pocket, and you could mail it to them in Texas or California or wherever they were, and then they would employ it on synthetic wall materials or whatever. But no, I've never studied color any more than any other architect would have, the kind of thing you do in school. But on the other hand, color isn't terribly difficult. I don't know whether people really know that or not, but with a little intelligence and a little sense about what you're doing, there are lots of ways that you can change the value of color in an effort to have it do what you want it to do. If you simply know what to mix with what, that part isn't terribly difficult.
You use colors on walls, and I think the kind of reigning philosophy recently has been that white or off-white walls are the easiest on the eyes, the least busy, and if you have anything to hang on the walls, paintings or whatever, that the white walls will show it off to its best advantage. Do you think you've disproven that in your experience?
I probably have to some extent in certain kinds of buildings, but I certainly haven't in museums. And that's where the question really becomes interesting. Can you think of a museum up until the turn of this century that had white walls? Never would you see a museum that was not a part of the painting, a part of the continuation of the thematic ideas that are embodied in the paintings, whether wall paintings or easel paintings. It's only with modernity that we get this idea of neutrality, an abstraction, sheer abstraction of the wall as if it were not there, so that the painting can exist on this armature of nothingness. And it's a very, very difficult thing to break. Tom Armstrong, the director of the Whitney Museum, was recently at a dinner and was sitting next to Frank Stella's wife. And if I remember the story correctly, and I think I do, Stella's wife said, "I wonder why museums insist on painting walls white. You know, Frank doesn't work on white walls. He would just as soon his paintings be put on colored walls." Now, obviously, there are colored walls and there are colored walls, so one has to be very careful, and it's not as if you're going to coordinate the walls with the paintings as a kind of decorator would, but nevertheless, there are there's a kind of substantive idea behind the, or a syntax within a building that would allow both walls and paintings to live together in the painted world, and I see no conflict with it, never have, but my clients do, because we're now working on three museums, and the curators have a hard time with it because they're all trained to think of the wall as background, the wall as something that is necessary to put a nail in for the painting and little else. When that happens to us, when the curators win the day, we generally have our way when it comes to the public spaces, that those places of movement and congregation and auditoriums and lobbies and that sort of thing, where we can show them what it could be like. And in time, maybe those curators will go away and there'll be a new batch of fresh air.
The colors that you use are pretty muted. Do you usually try to find a correlation in nature for the colors you use, or is that irrelevant to you?
Well, as I said before, there is usually an analogous idea with nature, whether it's green or blue red as terracotta. But the other thing that happens, and you use the word muted, is that there is an architectonic sense to the colors, I think, or an attempt to do that, in that the time I've spent in Rome and in Europe, one is used to the buildings fading in time under the sun. And so whether a stucco wall has been painted to resemble limestone or travertine or brick or marble and is still simply painted, as we know the great housing stock of places in Italy and south of France are all in that manner, those buildings have faded in time and have generally not been repainted. It's one of the reasons we go there, because we like that sense of not just the antique but the nostalgic idea of buildings and the buildings in their place and sense their history. While in this country we repaint them every 5 years and we never have that. And there's a kind of necessity to keep us spick and span here, which is awkward sometimes. But nevertheless, when one sees that chalky whiteness enter the paint or enter the stucco, as you do in Latin countries, it's that quality of light that I would use, and even a painter like de Kooning or informally Piero would use in the painting to evoke that idea of time and also the architectonic sense of the girthiness of the wall. So it's not done out of trying to make the colors more ephemeral so much as to give them a sense of depth.
Since you've brought up paintings, let me ask you what other painters you feel an affinity for.
Oh, the list is pretty long. But certainly Piero and Raphael and Michelangelo. And then presently I have, I guess I like early de Kooning and early a lot of people, but not so much the abstractionists and the field painters. I get little joy from that. If I were offered them, I'd probably reject them. I really can't find it in those paintings. Can't find any sense of identity with the things that I like. But before the current scene in painting, and it seems that they too are returning to a kind of figurative idea, or many painters are. There are, of course, the Surrealists and the Dadas and people like de Chirico and Mirandi, who followed that, that are figurative in their way, that one gets inspiration from not only in the color and texture and the formal qualities, but also the architectural qualities, especially in somebody like de Chirico, who's been very influential in the whole movement in European architecture today called rationalism. If one wants to find the precursor of all that, I sense that it would have to be de Chirico.
Architect Michael Graves is my guest if you're just joining us, and there's an exhibit of his models, sketches, furniture and textiles now on display at the Moore College of Art Gallery on 20th and Ray Streets. We've talked about imagery and design in your work. Maybe we could talk about a specific building and see how that functions within it. Why don't we try the building that you did recently in Portland, Oregon, that's now completed.
What would you like to know about it?
Well, maybe you could describe first the outside of it, the structure of it and the colors, and talk about some of the concepts behind that.
Well, we started the design with the idea of the building fitting into the local context. Now, I should explain that. The context is obviously varied because Portland has, in the recent past, experienced an enormous boom, like Seattle has in the Northwest. And so there are a lot of modern buildings, a lot of reflective glass there. And at the same time, there was another period in the turn of the century and up to about 1920, when Portland built a lot of buildings out of terracotta, glazed terracotta, because there isn't a lot of freezing weather there, and therefore terracotta is a very reasonable building material to use. Therefore there is this kind of juxtaposition within the kind of Victorian stock of housing. There's the neoclassic former buildings of the early 20th century, and then of the last 20 years, there are the modern guys that stand and reflect those earlier buildings. Our context was both, at least, both the classical one, the neoclassical one, and the modern one. And our context was also one of city government in terms of the institutions on the site, because to one side we have the city hall and to the other side the county courthouse of our building. A third side of our building fronts on the main shopping street of Portland, Fifth Avenue, and the back side of the building, if you can call it that, faces a park that is surrounded by city and government buildings. So we had this rather mixed context of nature on one side, shopping on the other, and then two government buildings on the third and fourth sides. The building functions as kind of overflow for both of the adjacent buildings, City Hall primarily, whose bureaucratic offices have been located all over the city for the last 40 or 50 years as the city has grown, and the county courthouse on the other side. So it's really an annex to both of those buildings and stands between them. It's unfortunate that it had to be so much bigger in size than they did, because it gets a kind of dominance from its size that it probably doesn't deserve, given that the county and the city symbolic centers are more important than it is. But it acts as a kind of, or attempts to act as a kind of glue to those two buildings, as a kind of hinge between their mutual activities, and also a kind of hinge between the commercial side of town and the park side of town, and then the park gives over to the view of the Willamette River and Mount Hood and Mount St. Helens on the other side of the river. So that part of the context on the ground floor was also identified, I guess you could say, with a rather marvelous program that was written by the city, which asked us to provide commercial establishments on the ground floor of this city building. So it's interesting that you have a donut shop and a coffee shop and a bar and a restaurant and a clothier on the ground floor of a city hall annex. But what indeed happens because of that is that the city stays alive at the ground floor, and after the offices above are closed, of course, the ground floor is still alive. And it was also thought that it would be a good idea, as many buildings in Portland are covered at the ground floor with awnings and loggias or arcades, because of the enormous number of days that it rains in Portland, we would provide the same kind of cover for those shops at the ground floor. So we have a covered arcade around three sides of the building, and that acts to reinforce the shopping side of the building. Those first three ground floors, which act as a base for the building, are built of glazed terracotta, like the former 19th and early 20th century buildings that we found, for that kind of textural reference. And it is also those floors of tile, those first three floors covered in ceramic tile, are colored kind of dark green or medium green, gray-green, and therefore there's a kind of reference to the park on the other side at the height of the tree level on the other side is about coincident with the height of the third floor of our building. And springing from that are the two levels of the building, which are the dominant levels of the building. First, that will be occupied by the city and county, and next, the top five floors, which are rented out to all comers in the city as a commercial office space. They do that to help pay for the rent on the building. So the city needed only 10 floors, but built 15, which was a bright thing to do as well. And then the commercial office space pays back a portion of the rent that they have to pay, or the rent on the money that they borrowed to build the building. The building from that third floor up through the 15th is colored in two parts. There's a central core of the building, which reflects the idea of the elevators and the core of any office building. And I say core, I'm using it that way because formerly, you know, we built our buildings more or less horizontally. If you think of Rome or London or Paris, those cities are by and large horizontal. Our cities, our new cities, are by and large vertical. Of course, we built our cities more or less after the invention of the elevator. And so while Rome or Paris or London were essentially monuments by the time Mr. Otis invented the elevator, the idea of movement in a building was always seen as a sort of hierarchical promenade, or as the French say, the architectural marche through the building, and one was able to determine the hierarchy of spaces and rooms by virtue of that promenade. That's no longer the case when buildings move vertically and use the ground much differently. And in a sense, they're anti-classical when you do that. I mean, the classical idea of identification, the human body's identification or mind's identification with the wall and the building and its space and its character, is in a sense thrown out of the window when you get in an elevator. So what we tried to do was to recall the idea of the marsh or that symbolism by virtue of making a little bit more of the core or that kind of movement structure within the building with two rather large columns or the recall of columns on the facades of the building, which recall then the paired elevators that move up through the building and also give you a sense of the kind of firmness of the building or structure of the building as it rises up through the center of this rather large mass. Now, I say rather large mass, given it's only 15 stories, it isn't a skyscraper. It is this kind of lumpish building because of the very low budget. We had to find a way to make the kind of smallest volume possible to stay within the budget, which was $51 a square foot. It was very, very difficult in a city building with lots of energy requirements and site requirements in a difficult site, which sloped 10 feet from one end to the other, and all of that sort of thing then required that we make this rather lumpish building. It's been called a sky lump, I think, by Charles Jenks. I thought maybe a ground bump was better, but nevertheless, it's difficult for the architect then to aspire to anything that would be a little more slender, the way one might think of something going up 150 feet in the air. And so this center core also helps, aesthetically at least, in the building to lessen the load, as it gives you a sense of bearing on the whole building. At the same time, it gives you a kind of center of the building which is more slender, with the corners of the building then being more ephemeral. And they're painted concrete, which again was a requirement of the city, the building to be built out of a concrete frame, primarily for both cost and for earthquake resistance. The cream color then is similar again to the color of much of the ceramic tile that one finds in town, the turn of the century buildings that I mentioned before. And so you have a green base and the kind of cream corners with a terracotta paired columns in the center, which rise finally to a 15th terrace floor, which is the city planning agency, which you know that they'd get the best view. And their floor is painted a kind of pale gray-blue, which is, again, the soffit of the building, the head of the building, the top and most upper part of the building, where there are two porches, one on Fifth Avenue, one on Fourth Avenue, or the park side, where you can look back on the Fifth Avenue side to the residential hills beyond Portland, and then on the Fourth Avenue side, or the park side, look to the Willamette River and Mount Hood.
How did you resolve the question of will the windows open, which they don't in many modern office buildings, and in the interior, where you're going to have open space with movable partitions or conventional offices built in?
Well, the window question is a very interesting one. We proposed, and this was a competition you may know, and in our competition entry, we proposed what we call operable sash. In other words, all the windows in the building would open. And the scheme was slightly different then, but it was possible for anybody sitting at their desk to open their window. If it's 68 outside and you want it to be 68 inside, all you have to do is open the window. It seemed very reasonable to us. But because of the two factors in the city, it was later required that the windows be shut for all time. One factor was that they didn't want people at their desk to throw off the energy systems or the computers that ran the energy systems of the building by having the temperature variations more than the computer could handle within any room. And they also thought it would be hard on the maintenance crews. So we have two kind of phony ideas or reasons for closing the windows and making the heat and cooling run day and night in that building when it needn't, especially in a climate like Portland. I look forward to the day that the codes will require us as architects, and in that case as city governments, to have operable sash in every room.
Yeah, I'm really surprised that there's laws that would prevent you, or codes that would prevent you from having windows that open.
Well, it sounds so ridiculous, but it is the case there. I don't know whether it's the kind of American tidiness that causes that sort of thing, or it's whether they really believe that they'll save money by running the machinery and have a building that is constantly the same temperature, or whether they wanted to reduce the kind of inter-office squabbles that might occur when it's too cold for some and too hot for the others. I think they're also worried about rain coming in if somebody left the windows open at night. We tried a lot of ways to get around them, I must say. We said, all right, then we'll use a window that operates only for window washing. And that's a pivoting window. It's known, and it's an easy thing to acquire and not terribly expensive, and it keeps the window washer inside the building, and it's operated by a key. We knew very well that all the office workers would find the key and would be able to open the windows, but the city were a little quicker than we were and said, no, this is Portland, they'll find the key, so we'll see all the windows closed. But, you know, it's one thing that went wrong on that building, and there were a number, but all in all, the city acted brilliantly. They did a wonderful job in overseeing the construction and overseeing our work. I can't say enough good things about it after we finally won the commission. There were a lot of difficult times before we won the commission, to be sure, and which is history now. But the city and its architect wrote a brilliant program and then followed through on it, more or less.
Your architecture is pretty controversial amongst other architects and architecture critics. What kind of reactions have you gotten from the users of the buildings that are completed? And here I'm not talking about residences, but things like the office buildings or arts complexes.
Well, in the Portland building, certainly the reviews are mixed. I get letters from people who say they love coming to work in the morning. I get hate mail from people who say they hate the interiors because of its blandness. I didn't do the interiors of the building, and people don't know that. We did the public spaces. We did the lobbies and the arts gallery and the elevator core and a public hearing room. But that's about a floor and a half worth of a 15-floor building. And another local architect was given the job of the interiors. So your earlier question about what is the life like between the core and the glass line is a particularly good one, because I find, even though that architect is quite talented, in this particular case it's not his best work. And there's an open office landscape, which is one of the worst things that one could ever have to work in, and it's neither private nor public. You neither get the light or the privacy from a closed office or from a simple scattering of dust throughout the whole thing. So it's a compromise system, and I think it's mostly beige, and I wouldn't want to work there. But many of our showrooms, for instance, are denied light because they're in kind of World Trade Center places in various cities, Dallas, Chicago, Houston, Los Angeles, and so on, where there's oftentimes no light at all given to the series of the rooms that we make for showrooms in places like the Merchandise Mart in Chicago. And there are all kinds of ways to not just make believe, but give light a quality, incandescent light, fluorescent light, a quality that is unexpected and is the joy. It's not that you wouldn't rather have daylight, but in a building that's 150 feet deep, as the Portland building is, it's quite clear that everybody's not going to get a window. But somehow you expect it. So there ought to be a compensation, at least in the interior design of the offices, that something else takes the place of real daylight. And again, there are all kinds of ways that one can do that through paint and texture and qualities of artificial light that some may say never will measure up to the real thing. But I can tell you it goes a long way to alleviating the frustrations of folks who have to work in those office systems.
Architect Michael Graves is my guest. Did you design the interior of your own home?
Well, it's a long story, which I'll make short. I bought a warehouse 6 years ago and have been living in it and remodeling it in the early time. The first couple of years that I lived there, there was construction going on all the time. But then the practice was on hard times, and there wasn't a lot of money. And so it stopped. It seems now, though, that we're on a little surer footing in the office and I can pick up the construction again. But the warehouse is a marvelous building. It was built in 1926 by Italian masons who came to Princeton to build on the campus, masonry buildings on the campus. And they moonlighted this warehouse, which looks like more like a Tuscan barn, which is pretty close to my heart, on an awkward piece of property, but happens to face one of the few parks in Princeton, which on the other side is my office. So it's a very short walk. It couldn't have been a happier find for me. But little by little, we're remodeling this thing and hope to finish it off in the next year or so.
Is it frustrating to live in a place that's incomplete when you're designing everybody else's places?
Well, it's somehow everybody else takes precedent. You know, if a client walks in tomorrow and people in the office are doing the working drawings for my warehouse, it's quite clear that they'll be taken off that and put on the real work. So I don't know what to do about that, but we've discussed it in the office. It's become a kind of office joke, but I guess I'm tired of making believe, and I'd like to have the real thing.
Do you collect art?
I don't. I did this past year in a visit to the American Academy in Rome buy two very small paintings, about 8.5 by 11, from a young man who's there on the Prix de Rome. But those are the only pictures I've ever bought. I do collect artifacts, however, from flea markets and antique shops and that sort of thing, things that I somehow identify with, whether they're pieces of furniture or pottery or artifacts for the kitchen, but things that have some meaning in that they take their shapes from other artifacts, whether it's a pyramid or a head of Julius Caesar.
You've been designing furniture. How long have you been doing that?
Well, I've always been interested in it. When I first started working for an architect, which was in New York in 1959-1960, after leaving school, I worked for George Nelson, who was then a furniture designer, still is a furniture designer, but was working for Herman Miller at the time, though I worked in the architecture section of George's office. I always had an interest in seeing how the furniture was designed, what the process was, and how he worked with the manufacturers. That was a great lesson for me, because from college on, I was always drawing furniture, but never built very much, except what all architects do, I suppose, in furnishing their own apartments or houses. But for the past 5 years, we've been actively designing furniture for a couple of furniture companies, and rugs and artifacts like teapots and other things that are really quite rewarding, and that one gets to continue the life of the building past the wall and into the interior.
You can use it too. I mean, you just sit on it. I guess it has a different kind of reward than creating a building.
Well, it's an instant reward, I must say. A chair is designed and built a lot more quickly than a building is. So there's that gratification that comes with a shorter period of time. And there's also the kind of hands-on thing that you don't so much get with buildings. I mean, there is this awkward moment in a building where you've made a series of drawings which you you think are pretty close to what you want to do, but we don't any longer build our own buildings, obviously. But when we make furniture, we're making prototypes, and we can change it, and we can tune it, and we do that, and we might build a dozen prototypes before we get the thing to be as comfortable as we want it, and to have the texture of the wood or the metal or whatever to be as we want it. So that's rewarding in ways that building isn't, but buildings are something that obviously yield something that furniture doesn't. We obviously get to walk in them, and there's nothing like it.
Would you ever sacrifice comfort for design?
Well, I don't see them as any sort of conflict. There are those that think that if you look at a Barcelona chair and think that from looking at it, it will be comfortable, then sitting in it, it is comfortable for you. If you approach it in a psychological manner that steel and leather in that particular configuration will offer you some comfort, then you'll find it comfortable. If you look at it and it's alienating to you or so estranged from that you're used to before sitting on it, and you probably won't find it comfortable. But I don't really approach it from that point of view.
I think anyone with a bad back would have a much more practical interpretation of what's comfortable.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like separating the pragmatic attitude of a building that keeps you dry or warm from the poetic side of a building. They are very different and born out of two different interests, but they're absolutely compatible as the way syntax and semantics and literature are.
I think architects are like actors in that to get your part, you always have to compete against your colleagues. There's never enough work for everybody to be working. Is it very frustrating to always have to go compete with your colleagues every time you want to design a building?
Yeah, it would be wonderful for somebody to call me on the phone and say, would you design an XYZ building for me? And then the first thing I would say is, who else is on the list? And if they said, nobody, you're the one we want, it would be a great affirmation of or reaffirmation of what we'd like to hear. It rarely happens. It might happen on a house, but or recently it happened on an office building for us. But there are two kinds of competitions. One is a competition where you actually produce a design. You actually do drawings and models for a client to look at, and he may or she may have asked five or six other architects to do the same thing, and then you're compensated for that. Or you might have, a competition by interview. So, you know, for instance, on the Whitney Museum, we went through three or four rounds of interviews before we actually got the commission. It went from, I think, 20 down to 10, down to 5, and then 3, and then finally got the commission. It's pretty hairy, you know, and you know who's on the list every time, and you know it's hard to sometimes to keep your equilibrium with your friends when you see them and you have dinner with them and you frankly enjoy them and enjoy their company, but you bloody well want the job.
There are ethical decisions that architects have to make now in terms of which country they're willing to work in and what the politics of that country is.
Yes, that's true. We haven't gotten very many foreign commissions. We have had a couple of very small jobs in Italy. We've had some inquiries from some other people in other foreign countries that haven't worked out. We've designed a department store not yet built in Tokyo on the Ginza. But it would be fun to do that. It's a long way to go for a job meeting, obviously, but certainly with Romaldo Jergola here in Philadelphia designing the new capital of Australia, one knows the number of hours that he spends going to the site, and it's a tough thing to do. In a way, it was easier in times past before air travel, when Britain was colonizing. And they were sending their architects out to places like Cape Town and Johannesburg, the architects would draw on the boat and draw all the way there with their offices intact on the boat, present their schemes to whomever, whether they're going to India or whether they're going to South Africa or wherever. And then after they had been shot down or criticized by the client or the government, they could repair it all on the trip home. And they did exactly that. And there are wonderful records about all that. You can imagine the silence that you would have on the boat. Pretty hard to draw on an airplane.
Do you care for shopping malls?
I don't go to them very much. I don't know why they are the way they are, but I suppose it has to do with parking more than anything else, and the fact that most of us live in the boonies, you know. And so as our houses are imitations of Monticello or isolated objects in the landscape, as if we have to own a piece of the turf, so our shopping malls imitate our houses. You know, the Ranchburgers that what many of us live in out there beyond our towns and cities accommodate the hordes of the population of this country. And therefore, it seems quite natural as we have our car parked outside our house to have our car parked outside the shop. And it's probably the only way we can do it if we have to have that kind of convenience. And given this country has had a bias toward private transportation rather than public, it's never going to happen that we can convince Detroit or the federal government to change that attitude. So we're always going to drive. It's a pity that we don't, therefore, have a city or a number of cities that we can have reasonable shopping in and have the variety that we ought to have. But it's interesting now as the shopping malls are starting to repeat themselves and be these awful, dreary places with their own crime problems, that maybe the city isn't so bad after all.
Speaking of shopping, you've designed a shopping bag for Bloomingdale's. How did that commission come about?
Well, John Jay from Bloomingdale's called me one day and said, "We'd like to come out and visit you. We have a proposition for you." And here he came in his black chauffeur-driven Cadillac, and I thought it was very impressive. And he came in his black suit and his black briefcase, and he was very spiffy, and I was terribly impressed. And he was a very well-designed person. But out of his briefcase came these shopping bags that they had already done based on my designs of other things. It was very difficult to resist once you had seen half a dozen shopping bags in miniature that John had put together to convince me that it was really all right to do this. He thought probably what I would say is that I didn't have time to just choose one of the other artifacts or one of the other things that we had drawn or made or painted. And they would use it, but instead I wanted to make this new object, this vessel, and did. I wanted to do it for another kind of reason, which was to get to know people at Bloomingdale's, and as I'd like to get to know other people, because they are, in terms of the residential field and the consumer field, other than the kind of furniture that I work, I design, which is really meant for the professional buyer, for his clients, it's very nice to know their sources, so that if I design a rug or a teapot or a line of flatware, I'd like to know where Bloomingdale's gets them made. It's like asking Conrad's. It's like asking any other place that there's a large commercial market. And while it would be nice to design for Tiffany's, it would also be nice to design for Conrad's or Bloomingdale's. And where the rugs and artifacts that we have been making have been made at an enormous cost because they're made of very fine materials and they're done with the best materials, as I say, by the best craftsmen. It would be nice to know sources, for instance, in the south of France or in Spain, where there's a rug industry that I'm unaware of, but folks from Conrad's and Bloomingdale's know about, and where you can cut the cost by a third and still have master craftsmen working on it. You simply have to know where they are. And anybody that's been connected with furniture design and furniture manufacture knows that we've lost a whole range of interests in the craft ability of this country to produce wooden furniture, for instance, at a reasonable cost. The whole industry has swung over to steel and metals of various kinds and plastics, and it's very hard, except in a place in North Carolina or in Zeeland, Michigan, to find those craftsmen. Yes, there are folks here in Philadelphia that can make wooden furniture, but they make it one-off. And how to find somebody still involved in craft of wood furniture is something that interests me in an enormous amount, and I'd like to know the folks that then employ those. And it's a network that I don't know and would like to.
Just one other thing I wanted to know briefly about the shopping bag. I thought it was almost conspicuous for the absence of the Bloomingdale's name on it.
Well, that's interesting about Bloomingdale's. They've never had their name on their shopping bags. Oh. They will. They might use Missoni's name on it, but they won't use their own. I think they're the only one that does that.
Are you at the point now where you're having to turn down projects because you're being offered so much?
I wish that were true. No, I think people are still frightened of us. We are getting to do a lot of different kinds of things, from, as you say, the bag for Bloomingdale's to the artifacts to sets for things like the Joffrey Ballet, but no, the phone doesn't ring nearly enough, and I'm sure there are marvelous commissions out there that we don't have. In fact, at this time, I'm a little worried that in the next 6 months to 8 months that we'll run out of work. So the popularity is one thing, but the clients actually calling you is something else.
Is it tied to the economy?
I don't think so. Our work has never been tied to the economy. We've always done very, very well in very hard times, and in lucrative times, we've struggled. So I guess because we do something that some other folks don't do, and we're kind of one-off, maybe people will always come to us for that kind of thing.
Well, I enjoy your work very much, and I want to thank you enormously for visiting with us on Fresh Air. It's been really interesting. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Architect Michael Graves has been my guest. He's won many awards as a professor at Princeton University. And there is a show of his work now on exhibit at the Moore College of Art, and it includes models, sketches, furniture, and textiles. The show will be on exhibit through October 15th, and it's at the Moore College of Art Gallery on 20th and Ray Streets in the Moore Building. And again, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. And this is Sheila Jordan and bass player Harvey Swartz.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Don't mean a thing, all you gotta do is sing. Makes no difference if it's sweet or hot. Give the rhythm everything you have got. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Swinging's real easy, it's not hard to do. That feeling, all you gotta do is get the rhythm into you. Makes no difference if it's right or wrong, as long as you keep swinging with the song. Swing high, high, ho, ho. Now you're swinging with a swing. Swing, 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 swing. Everybody start to swing. High, high, ho, ho. Now you're swinging with a swing. Thank you. ain't got that swing. Do what, do what, do what, do what, do what, do what. Do what, do what, do what, do what, do what.